Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage, the podcast. I'm Chet Haas from the Developer Relations team.
I'm Romain Guy from the Android Toolkit team.
And today we are joined by...
I'm Anna Goldie. I'm joining from the Google Brain team.
Google Brain?
That sounds so much better than our teams.
Who'd have thought? I'm going to give that to you as like the possible future slogan for the team. Who'd have thought? Turns out Google Brain. All right, so what is Google Brain? What do you do there?
Okay, so we're basically like a machine learning research or AI research team.
Okay.
And I think we're very focused on deep learning historically. We also do reinforcement learning.
So you already used several words. AI, machine learning, there was deep learning.
Yeah.
Actually, I understood the individual words. I did not understand how they were used
right,
together.
So is there a difference between all those things?
There are. So I think it's like basically like a tree. So the superclass is AI. So all of the words I described are types of AI or subfields of AI. So I would say that the next highest class would be machine learning is a subclass of computer of AI. And then reinforcement learning and deep learning are both branches of machine learning.
All right, let's go down the tree then. What is the what's the specialty of machine learning? I've always wondered because I've heard the terms used interchangeably. I think of ML as being the current trendy phrase for AI.
I know, Chet. I read that on Twitter. AI, it's when it's written in PowerPoint, and machine learning, it's when it's written in Python.
That's kind of true. I feel like people like to rebrand themselves as machine learning because it sounds like more concrete. Yep. I think because AI is a broader class, like it also includes a bunch of like bullshit in addition to real things. So
that's a good
I think that's part of what's going on with that.
So AI, I mean, to be clear, like AI has been a thing since what, 60s? Like when did all that research begin? I know there was active stuff going on in the mid 80s. And it was also something that has gone sort of in and out of favor as people think, oh, this is, you know, obviously the future of all computing everywhere. And then it doesn't quite solve all those problems. And then it goes away for a few years. And now it's back.
That's right.
Well, and that term in between was used for various things, like in games, obviously. I wrote AI for a game and... It was just a bunch of if and else's. So, I don't think that's the same kind of AI you're doing.
So, I think that's part of the distinction, right? So, like, I think AI, this concept that have been around at least since the 60s. And I think originally people thought it's going to be a lot easier to achieve. Like, they thought, like, maybe a grad student could do this over the summer, like, solve NL, natural language processing, or all understanding of human languages. And obviously, that wasn't the case. And I think back in the day, AI was more about, like, if-then, like, symbolic reasoning, and then we found that didn't scale.
I remember like expert systems were kind of a trendy thing, sort of late 80s-ish, right?
Yeah, and then like it's all these like rules, and they don't really transfer to new problems. So
right.
I feel like even like Watson, it was like IBM system. It's like extremely impressive feat that they're superhuman at Jeopardy, but then like. I think there's a lot of rules in there, so it's like a huge amount of human effort went into building the system, and it doesn't actually transfer to new areas.
Right, because you kind of want the systems to be able to learn and not just process a large database of exact phrases and rules, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But that's true in general, right? Like we talk about artificial intelligence, but even with the new techniques, my understanding is that they tend to be highly specialized, right? If you train something to recognize some types of objects in photos, it can't play chess against you.
Yeah, like, it's very task specific. I think there's like a growing field of like multitask, but it's not so broad that it's like you take a vision model and apply it to language. But that's definitely like one of the frontiers. It's like, can we have one model that says does a bunch of different NLP tasks like translation and conversational modeling? Okay. But yeah, I think that AI has like gone through many cycles of like hype and disappointment, AI winters.
You know, we often joke with Chet that, you know, in the field of graphics and UI, and that's what we do or what we've been doing for many years, it's kind of a scam because we keep reinventing the same thing over and over again. I get the feeling that's true of your specialty as well.
There's something there because, like, for example, the latest hype or the strongest strain of machine learning right now would be deep learning. It actually works, right? These deep artificial neural networks have shown like dramatic results in, say, especially vision problems. But this concept has been around for like decades, right? This year, Yan LeCun, Yoshua Bengio, and Hinton won the Nobel Prize of Computer Science for their contributions to deep learning. But I mean, they made these like decades ago. There was a winter involving these neural networks.
Right.
There was a paper from MIT basically debunking them. because they showed that one layer neural networks couldn't do very fundamental tasks.
Right.
And then this led people to conclude that multi-layer perceptrons or neural networks also wouldn't be able to.
I see. So we debunked the debunking.
Yeah, exactly. Not, but they work. So it's like, I think people don't 100% understand why they work. So that's another very interesting
machine
area.
Machine learning.
Like, how can we interpret these models? How can we understand how they understand?
So what has changed? Was there a fundamental shift in, you know, knowledge? Or is that because we have more power than before? Is that because it was just ignored for a long time? It happened that we were not trying?
I think it's both, right? I think that we've had improvements in the optimization techniques that we have. I mean, certainly back propagation from Hinton was huge, but things like just using a better activation function.
I see Chet take a lot
Sorry,
of notes.
That's too much. Okay.
I heard back propagation and then I heard activation function. Activation function.
Okay, there's certain techniques for how can we help these neural networks learn patterns in the data. It's very important.
You have to treat Chet as a neural net. Okay. You have to train him.
Okay, there are certain improvements in the core algorithms, but also I think a huge amount more compute, right?
Right.
And data. So those are both huge. No matter how simple your model is, if you have enough data and compute power, you probably can do something.
And I assume that, like you said, there's a lot of hype artists, a lot of people are interested, so there's more research going on, more people discovering new things. And
actually, I'm thinking the compute power is kind of like we've gotten to Hamlet's monkeys, right? We have kind of the infinite monkeys available, so what could you write?
Just explore, exhaustive search all possible algorithms.
Yeah.
Fortunately, it's too large, so we know that we haven't reached that yet. But that's an area of research I'm excited about is how can we use machine learning to improve the compute power that we have? So that's an area of research that I'm working on. Can we feed machine learning back into itself?
I like the recursion of that, using compute power to require less compute power.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So earlier, in the tree description that you had, there was sort of AI and machine learning. It'd still be nice to see what you think is the key difference or speciality of machine learning, but also deep learning.
Okay.
So go.
Okay. So what is the key speciality of deep learning? What is it good
for?
Okay.
Well, I guess let's start with machine learning to begin with. Maybe.
Okay.
What's the thing when correct people say ML, what are they referring to that is different than all the generality of AI over the years?
Okay. So I would say machine learning to me means not rule-based systems.
Yeah.
Not symbolic systems. So And I think, at least so far, those have been more successful in solving real problems.
Go and
Go, or I don't know if that's a real problem, but
translation. Not civilization. What was the online multiplayer
StarCraft.
Game? StarCraft.
Yeah, that's very cool.
So
Dota. Yeah.
Okay. I love that. Chess. Basically, AI researchers are just trying to ruin games for everybody. It's what is wrong with you? You ruin chess, Go, and now video games.
But then we can get back to
work. Save people time; they don't have to play anymore.
Exactly.
But we want to play.
I know it doesn't make sense. I think it's a good baseline. So what's powerful about it is it's a simulation environment that is basically a perfect.
Yeah, there's a finite set
of
rules.
Of the actual task. So that's why people like to play games with AI. But it's not in and of itself a useful task, just
right.
as a benchmark. So that's why I would like to work on problems that actually have impact in the real world.
Right.
But anyway, so machine learning to me includes deep learning and reinforcement learning and all these modern techniques. It also includes some older school techniques that were very powerful in the past, but which we have since outperformed, SVNs and such. But we don't necessarily need to go into that.
We don't, but we could at least define what SVN stands for.
Support vector machines.
Okay.
It's also that old source control version.
I was thinking that. Yeah.
That's the one I know.
Okay. So then you defined machine learning in terms of deep learning, but I still don't understand what deep learning is.
Okay. So deep learning is a flavor of machine learning that involves basically deep artificial neural networks. So there's these artificial neurons.
So is that the
neurons.
Multiple layers you mentioned
exactly.
earlier?
Exactly. So you have these artificial neurons. They're very loosely inspired by the human brain. So they take in information or it's almost an electrical pulse from a previous neuron, some number coming in from a previous layer. They multiply it by some weights that they learn over time to improve, and then they apply some kind of nonlinear activation, and then they output it to other neurons that take it in and perform their own transformations. So it's actually pretty amazing that these
I when it's described like this, and also like, you know, if we go into more technical details, my understanding is that the also the type of values they work on are like pretty small, right? Like we're talking 8-bit, 16-bit tops.
Yeah.
Like the fact that it can do something meaningful doesn't make sense to me.
It's crazy, but. Right? And then people also do experiments with like quantization, like can they, you know, lower the precision of what they're passing in, and they can still get good results but use less compute. So there's just so many interesting directions.
So actually, speaking of the 8 versus 16-bit thing, what's the hardware that people are typically using for doing this stuff? Is this like specialized GPUs or specialized CPUs or just general purpose?
TPUs?
TPUs, yeah.
TPUs, I mean, that's the latest flavor. So you can use any of them. I think I saw a study recently, depending on the type of model, it runs better on different hardware. Like, we actually use CPUs pretty often, but we also use GPUs and TPUs. So basically whatever will run the model most efficiently, like things like convolutional neural networks, which are used in vision, like run very well on GPUs.
Yeah.
It's just like a really interesting side effect, like the fact that they're good for like graphics.
For rendering, they're good for...
Matrix multiplications like happen to play well for
so slightly related, but just because I mentioned TPU, what is a tensor?
Tensor processing. Okay, yeah. Let's talk about it. So a tensor is basically a multi-dimensional array.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I think if you see a matrix, as you'd expect it to be like two-dimensional, right?
Yeah.
A tensor can be arbitrarily dimensional.
Okay. Yeah, it reminds me of all those graphics paper I read where they always, the researchers love to use like really fancy words for things that are much more simple, like simple like manifolds or, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you read the paper, you spend half an hour, you're like, you mean you just do a for loop and you do the sum? It's like, okay, I get it. Can't you say that?
Then they don't get published.
Yeah, I guess so.
It's like for loops for.
Okay, so then a TPU, mm-hmm. the tensor processing unit, and the correct. Specialty, the difference between that and like a GPU or a CPU is like obviously the type of operations, but why?
It's like I would say it's like a more specialized form of hardware. Like it's less programmable, but it's like more heavily optimized for
also, I assume
neural
that
networks.
Because like you are confirming, because you don't need like very large data types, mm-hmm. you can probably do more operations in the same amount of transistors. Like same thing, GPUs, you can run, you know, 32-bit float computations or 16-bit float computations. And when you do 16-bit floats, mm-hmm. you can run twice as much basically. Mm-hmm. And so if you only need 8-bit, then
okay,
you can do increase the throughput a lot.
Yeah,
so
and I
assume
those
the TPUs have very high throughput. I think that's
okay.
And is that mostly is that integer math or float math or what kind of?
I think it's float math, but I'm not an expert on this.
Yeah, I was just asking because I could imagine that integer hardware would also be like, you know, much simpler. But anyway,
that's true. It'd be much lower precision, right?
So TPU stands for throughput unbelievable.
Basically,
okay. All right. So what kind of, how do people program these systems then? Like mm-hmm. what do people typically use?
What's the sort of developer?
Well, so you explain deep learning, you said like, you know, you have multiple layers of neurons. You explain like what mm-hmm. those neurons take in, what they take out, like, but how do you create one of those things?
Okay. Yeah. Let's talk about it. So you were saying earlier that machine learning people used Python. That's true, right? Or
apparently.
Yeah. So that's correct. And we also use TensorFlow. I think there's a bunch of other frameworks as well.
PyTorch?
PyTorch is also very good.
TensorFlow is language, or that's a library people are using
TensorFlow
from Python?
TensorFlow is like a library or a framework for deep learning. And there's like very nice like libraries or hooks for Python.
I see.
And there is also for C++, but I don't think people usually do that. Like I think for us, like for example, if we find that certain part of our workflow is like is a bottleneck, then we might like move it into C++ for performance reasons, but if you're prototyping, you usually use Python.
Given the choice, why would you pick C++?
For performance. Like, you can much higher.
Yeah, unless you have the performance issue, I understand why you would not go with it.
But for, like, I think usability or sort of...
Right.
So how did Python come to be the standard then? Is that just historical, or is there something in particular it offers?
I mean, I think it's, like, a very accessible language, right?
Yeah.
Well, also, historically, there's a number of, like, you know, there's NumPy and SciPy. There's a number of, like, really good, like, scientific libraries.
Yeah, I think that's a big part. And, like, oftentimes, like, say, TensorFlow will have an interface that parallels the NumPy or SciPy interface. Like, yeah.
Okay. Is it also because maybe these are tools and libraries and languages that are for people who aren't necessarily computer people? They are specialists in other domains and therefore a more approachable language is maybe a higher priority?
I think that's part of it. It's like a research scientist maybe is not a super hardcore software engineer and they want to be able to still prototype. I think if you want to build a production system in TensorFlow, then you do need to be like a hardcore developer.
Yeah.
Right?
While the computer scientists are arguing about which language to use and which compiler to use, you know, apparently they actually do get things done instead. all right. So you use Python most likely.
I usually use Python. Okay. And then for something that's performance intensive, I would use C++.
Yeah.
And maybe make Clif wrappers into Python. And then I use Python to call TensorFlow. And TensorFlow would be how you would specify the model. You would say like how many layers you want, or
so that's something that I always wonder, because I've never tried to build a deep learning network myself. So how do you figure out like how many layers do I need, how many neurons do I need, what are the activation functions? Like, can you take us through the process? Like,
yeah, like
what do you do basically, I assume, like as your job?
So it's good to start simple usually, and then usually based on the shape of the problem, you have some idea from the literature, like, okay, vision models tend to do, like convolutional neural nets tend to do well with vision models. So maybe since this is like a vision problem, maybe I'd start with that. But
so it sounds like part of the value of someone like you is like the experience, you know, like when approaching a new problem, like you already have a fair idea of like how you're going to solve it.
Like I have a good idea about which types of models worked well and which types of problems. And then there's so many different like hyperparameters and decisions that you're making though. And to some extent it's about your intuition, your past experience, and to some extent it's about just trying things and seeing what works in a new problem.
So could we build a neural net that would pick the model for you?
Yeah, that's
I assume it's already been done.
So like my manager actually, Kwok Lee, he is working on AutoML. That's a moonshot in brain. And the idea is basically exactly that. Can we have a machine learning model that learns, that generates a machine learning model that does well in the task? And
Chet, they're doing it wrong. They're putting themselves out of a job.
Exactly. What are we thinking? But that's actually, like, that is launched in cloud. So, I mean, that would be very powerful potentially, because people who didn't necessarily need to know about machine learning can get the power of machine learning.
So you said earlier, okay, so you do all this work and then you use Python to actually call TensorFlow. And okay, and this is where my mind gets a little confused, because there is the model that you build and then there's the model that you use for doing the thing.
Oh, the inference versus training or what?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so for
You're talking about like training, like creating the model?
So in TensorFlow, at least like traditionally, you build a graph and you specify it in TensorFlow or Python calling TensorFlow, and then you run that graph, you execute it. In training mode, it's really not that different than serving mode, if that makes sense. In training mode, you have like labeled data, like you have some input and you have what you expect the output to be, and you have some kind of loss function that you use to update your model. So basically you have this forward pass where you run through, you pass inputs into this neural network, and then you get some output at the end, and then you know what you wanted the answer to be, you compare them and you kind of back propagate. For each weight, if it had been slightly different, you would have gotten something closer to the right answer, and you sort of go backwards through your neural network.
So is it your job to, given an output, you know, at the beginning you send your input, you get an output, obviously it's going to be wrong, I assume.
Yeah.
Is it your job to figure out like the function that defines how wrong it is? Or
you have to define, you have to choose your own loss. Of course, like you can see what people have done historically, and there's a lot of like very standard losses.
Okay.
But it's very important. If you get the loss wrong, then your neural network won't learn. And it starts off basically random, like random weights. So,
right, I see.
So basically in training mode, you go forward, you go back, and then you update the weights. In when you're trying to, say, use the model, like let's say you have a translation model, now you want to make predictions about what the translation should be, you just only do the forward part. That's the difference. Because you don't know what the answer should be.
Yeah, you don't want to change the network.
And you can maybe like find some kind of signals, like the human didn't like the, you somehow detect that he didn't like it and then use that to learn. But
okay, and TensorFlow is used for all this stuff, because I also get a bit confused where, when are we using TensorFlow and when are we using ML commit kit? I think is on top of that, or is that just not something you deal with at all?
So you can use TensorFlow like in production, which is I think one of the advantages of TensorFlow. So like TensorFlow serving is specifically about like using the same model that you trained in production. I think maybe, I don't know if PyTorch you can.
So if we take a step back, so you mentioned, so you run your input forward through the network, you have some loss function, you know that it's wrong, you backpropagate, so you change the weights, trying to find, you know, the right weights. But you also mentioned the activation functions for the neurons. So what are those, and are they fixed? Do they evolve as well during the training?
So those are also a decision that you make.
Okay.
And there's a number of different, like you can use a tang function, you can use like a ReLU, you can use a sigmoid. Basically the goal is you want to kind of push the value somewhere between 0 and 1 so that like the weights don't get out of control as you propagate through the network.
Right. But that's a decision you make as the...
Yeah, you choose. When you and so I think for certain things, like I think language models like tang activation functions do better. And then there's a bunch of different...
And so do you have the same activation function for all the neurons in a layer?
You don't have to.
Okay.
I mean, usually you would, but you... That's another decision you make. There's just sort of this explosion of choices.
Yeah, it sounds like you make all this. Number of neurons, how they're connected, is that you as well, or is that TensorFlow?
Yeah, you can choose the width, the depth of the network. There's a lot of research going on about infinitely wide neural networks and how those somehow approximate like a Gaussian kernel, and does that even apply to very wide but not infinitely wide?
So now I'm picturing you just turning an infinite number of knobs in front of your computer until something comes out that you like.
It strikes me as the equivalent of what we've always talked about in graphics, where like it doesn't matter if it's correct, it just matters if it looks good enough. Like,
that's
do you
true.
Just end up turning the knobs until you're like, yeah, that's closer? We'll
I think
go with
it's
this.
A combination of like, okay, your personal experience, the experience of the whole ML community in the form of papers that you've read, your intuitions, and then trying some subset of the knobs that you have time to explore and compute to do so. Like, if you explored every choice, it would be impossible, right?
Okay. And it's going to be a different solution for every domain that you're creating a model for, right?
Yeah, you know, potentially.
Images versus translation versus whatever.
I mean, I think like one of the areas of interest is, like, can we see whether models can do well in multiple tasks at once? Obviously, humans can, right?
Yeah.
Some, given the same model.
Some of them.
Yeah.
Chet, you're not that good at multitasking.
I'm sorry, I'm not listening to you right now.
So, let's see. Yes, I forgot what I wanted to ask. See, I'm not good either. Single-tasking, apparently.
I should point out, we should maybe have pointed out at the beginning of the show, this show has nothing to do with Android. We just thought it'd be really cool to learn more about machine learning. But I am curious where some of these things sort of cross into. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, this is where Android developers interact with it. One of the ways is MLKit, which maybe that's like for doing stuff on a local device, given the model that you've already created. But there's also the NNAPI. Like, I'm just throwing these things out.
If
I remember correctly, the NNAPI are the abstraction layer for the hardware to run your models potentially
on
hardware we have that, you know, like DSPs or whatever. And MLKit, we had an episode, so we should remember. But I think it was things built on, like, you have models that already exist and you can use your own data with them. So that was the easy, like, you know, turnkey approach to...
Yeah, it was definitely for using models that were created probably from TensorFlow. The thing that I'm trying to understand is, wait, but TensorFlow can also be used to use those models. So, like, what's the value add for MLKit? Maybe it's just a more approachable API.
Maybe it's a high-level API. I don't know because I don't want to speculate since I don't
know. But I think that's what you were saying. Like, you know, you have, like, so many parameters. You talk about hyperparameters.
Yeah.
And so someone did that work.
Exactly.
And
I mean,
MLKit
many,
for you. And
yeah.
I think there's many, like, layers. Like, there's high-level APIs like Keras. But I think that you can use vanilla TensorFlow. Or you can go even deeper. Like, let's say you're on the TensorFlow team. You can start contributing to TensorFlow. You can look within each op and its exact specification. So you can go as deep as you want. And if you're doing novel work, sometimes you end up going deeper than you might like.
So I remember that question. So you mentioned, you know, you need to feed your label data, your inputs. You want to compare to an output. Where do you get the data from?
Like, okay, I mean, that's huge.
It sounds like a huge problem, like, if
it
you want
is.
To train a network.
Because I feel like it's all about the data, right? Because... these algorithms are not as smart as people, so they need way more examples than we need, and ideally labeled. So let's say, okay, one major branch of machine learning is supervised learning, and that's like examples, like labeled examples. Like, you have an input and an output,
so I assume
and that's
a lot
the one
of
that works the best, that we is the easiest and the best understood, right?
Right, so it sounds like a lot of computer vision is well-suited for this kind of learning, right?
Yeah. I think reinforcement learning or unsupervised learning are... harder, but they
so
don't
what is
require
that
labels. Okay, so supervised learning is you have input-output pairs. Unsupervised learning is like you just have a lot of data, but you don't really know what it means. Can the model somehow learn by ingesting that and finding patterns, like learning representations that are useful for understanding it or clustering it or things like that. Even the objective is sometimes not as clear. It's just a lot harder and it's kind of open.
That sounds like something that someone made up to make sure that whatever they build will be considered a success. It's like, oh yeah, you know, like we didn't know what we wanted to get, so look, it's a success, like it got something. Promotion. Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, like, one interesting area is, like, semi-supervised learning, where it's, like, you kind of define your objective as, say, like, you look at the whole internet, but you remove words randomly from the sentences, and you try to predict them, things like that.
Right.
Where it's, like, you don't have to label it, but you can learn something from this vast existing body of text. Sorry, what were you going to say?
So I was going to dive into games, not because it's an interesting thing, but maybe because it's like a specific example that maybe we could understand more about. So there are these examples of, you know, using machine learning and training things will get better at, like, playing the game way faster than anybody else. I think there was, like, an example in some Atari games, and it basically figured out all the cheats along the way and could go through these levels amazingly fast. And I would say, is that supervised learning or is that unsupervised, where there's a specific goal of stay alive as fast as possible and then you just let it go?
That's actually, like, that third branch that I wanted to talk about next, so it's perfect. It's reinforcement learning with most of these games. So there's no, like, clear answer. It's not like, oh, here's the game and then here's the answer, right? It's like, you're in this world, and like either you're like trying to survive or you're trying to get to the end of the level or whatever. And so you basically have this environment that you're operating in, you're taking actions, and you're getting rewards.
Okay, so that sounds like the branch of AI that led to so many jokes I read online where, you know, when the ML system will over-optimize for the reward. Like, yeah. I love that example of, like, reward a robot hacking to, like, flip craps. And, like, you know, the rewards, basically, the longer the crap stays in the air, the less likely it is to fall. So it would just throw the crap really hard and would stick to the ceiling. And it's like, I won. Like, you know.
Exactly. Like, it's really, like, the algorithm will find ways to cheat, basically. All it knows is it wants to optimize this.
Yeah, it sounds like teaching a child where, like, they don't understand, like, where you have to specify, like, all the goals and all the steps along the goal.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like if you can correctly define your reward function to be the thing you actually care about, it's very much more likely to be successful. Right.
So the cheating thing reminds me of something from the AlphaGo movie, which is really good documentary. Just enjoyable as a movie and sort of covering some of these concepts where it created strategies for playing that no human had tried ever more because it was optimizing globally instead of locally, right? Not trying to stay in front of the game, but rather to win eventually. Whereas, and that actually worked there. It wasn't a cheat. It wasn't flipping the crepe onto the ceiling. It was still optimizing for the correct goal, which was the final result.
It was very interesting because you saw with, like, AlphaGo, it tends to, like, win by very little, but then it always wins.
Yeah.
Or not always, but weirdly, very often, high percentage of the time, right?
Yeah.
Because it's optimizing for winning, not for, like, having more stones. It doesn't care about how much it wins by.
Right. And in that case, I guess the rules of the game are so well defined and the rules of what it is trying to optimize are so well suited that it did the right thing for the goal, for what the intended goal was and not just the stated goal of, you know, keep the crate.
Right. I mean, because in an example of video games, if the only goal you have is to stay alive, I assume in most games the best thing to do is don't even stop playing, right?
Right.
Just stay where you are.
Exactly. Yeah. You have to be very careful with how you define it. Or another interesting thing about reward function engineering is that, let's say you have a game where you're trying to, what's like Montezuma's Revenge or something, where it's a very, very long game. And so if your goal is, like, win the game at the end, it's just too hard for the agent to learn anything. It's just not getting signal for so long. So, but if you can define a reward in terms of, like, exploring the environment or trying things, if you give it intrinsic rewards, then it does much better. Because it learns that it needs to, like, try to see states that it hasn't seen before, and it ends up.
So do we ever use, like, combinations of neural networks where, like, you know, one would, like, you know, force the AI to explore, but there would be, like, a more global one that would say, okay, the goal is to win and I'm going to use
Exactly. Usually you have a mixture, like, maybe you're trying to optimize some end reward and then you're also trying to, say, maximize entropy, which is kind of like exploration. And if you balance those correctly, then your agent does better.
Although you want to make sure not to feed in too many constraints of our own mental model. So in the AlphaGo example, it's good that they didn't say, oh, and by the way, always stay in a winning position once you're there.
Right? You don't want to be, like, too conservative or too, like, their local optima.
Yeah.
And the other thing is just like people have ideas about what's good. Like, you know, for example, old chess programs would give certain point values per piece and such, but maybe they're not correct.
Right.
So it's better if we, ideally we have it just end to end and the model learns what's matters, but then sometimes the space is too large and too complex,
that's
where so we need to help it.
That's why we could be injecting our own bias based on our own experience with those games, our goals, and
exactly.
But there might be another way. And yeah, it's interesting.
So the other thing I was going to ask about games was a few months ago I was talking to my son who's studying SAS right now, and I was saying something about ML, and I think I had brought up that game, the
StarCraft.
Online multi- thank you. you can tell I've never played this game. And I said, oh, did you see this thing? You know, because they did that AlphaGo thing in the past. And he paused and he said, do they use machine learning for anything besides games? Like for anything productive? And so I know they do, but I did not have that example off the top of my head. So I was curious, like, what are some of the more interesting things that you've seen in the real world?
Yeah, because I feel like these games are very high
translation.
Profile.
Yes.
But I think, translation. That's like a service that is powered by machine learning and actually used by people. I think there are other like use cases that are kind of earlier, more nascent, but like say detecting cancer in slides. I think the brain medical team has made a lot of progress on that, like pathology. I think they're superhuman on that.
Yeah.
I've done work in say using RL to optimize the runtime of TensorFlow. So by more optimally partitioning the model across multiple compute devices.
Yeah.
So I feel like there's lots of like areas where we can have machine learning to improve hardware.
Right.
I've seen very promising research in animations for 3D characters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a big issue typically in games, you have like canned animation, like walking, running, climbing, and then you try to blend. Like, you know, if you're running with a character and you jump on a wall and it has to start climbing, you know, you have like some algorithm that blends the two animations. But machine learning gives amazing results, especially it can adapt to like different terrains, and you know, like the character can like stumble realistically over pebbles, that kind of stuff.
Hmm.
And it seems like a perfect way to apply this kind of stuff, because doing it by hand would take forever. And
yeah, it's insane. I mean, I think there's people who are working on, say, like making better game AIs, using machine learning.
I wonder if they could
or
go
QA,
back.
Like.
Like, apply the algorithm to the Polar Express movie? Except I think the answer would be it would just delete the movie.
There's also a lot of research in rendering appearance of materials using machine learning. Because, you know, we do a lot. It's all based. Right now, what happens is that people measure materials. They take photos or whatever. And then someone tries to come up with a mathematical function that seems to fit. And that's exactly what neural nets do, right?
Yeah. Like they find the right transformation.
Yeah, and they tend to always have limitations. Like, well, this one works for plastics and this other one works for metals. And so it's nice to like automate this a little bit.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, because then they could apply different situations, you know, to an infinite amount and make sure that they find the function that works the best across all of them, right?
Yeah, and more importantly, some of the research I've seen where they can create new materials that haven't been seen by the neural nets, but they can be inferred. If you know enough about other types of materials, you can then blend them, basically.
Yeah. There's interesting work with, like, proteins, too, like designing proteins that will fold in a certain structure or discovering exoplanets. Someone on my team found new exoplanets and gets to name them now. So, I mean, there's just so many cool things you do, or sort of related to what you were saying about figures interacting in a simulated world. The applications to robotics are very interesting. So can you learn something in simulation, but then what is the simulation reality gap? Can you have, you know, arms in warehouses doing things? Like we have at Rain, like an arm farm. We had these extra arms left over from something and we're like, we should just...
So I work on robotics at Google.
And
one of the reasons we are also thinking about doing this simulation was not only to, you know, do it better, but building a lot of robots is expensive and can be dangerous. So it's nice, to make them dream effectively and run tons of scenarios. Or, you know, when you're in California and you'd like to see how they work outside in the rain, it's like either you wait for a year and you have 1 week of testing or, lots of interesting applications. And we use it too on Android, right? Like usually it's in conjunction with other things. I think that's what we did with the auto brightness, right? We started using machine learning, but it was not like a full machine learning system. It was used to like feed into like some manual algorithm And I think it has evolved since then, but...
Right. And there's user control as well. Like, it will make decisions, and yet you can also tweak those decisions to do the right thing for you, right? So I was curious, maybe a little off topic, but how did you get into this, especially since, like, this field did not exist in the same strength that it does right now, right? Mm-hmm. I think for the last 2 years, ML has sort of really taken off, right?
Yeah, it's definitely... So... When I was in high school, I was, like, very excited about everything. Like, I loved math. I loved, like, French literature. I loved all the things, right? But I didn't know what I wanted to do.
All the things.
But then I did a summer program at MIT where we were introduced to, like, electrical engineering, computer science, and discrete math. And I heard this, like, lunch lecture by Professor Victor Zhu on, like, basically dialogue system. So it was this, like, computer system that could understand human language and respond naturally in it. And that idea was just so exciting to me. Hmm. And I was like, okay, this is what I want to do. And so I went to MIT and I studied computer science and linguistics, and I worked on conversational systems in his lab, actually.
Okay.
Wait a minute. I use computers when I don't want to talk to someone. Don't make them talk.
Well, sometimes it's scary to talk to real people, right?
That's true.
So I guess the system I worked on was basically, the goal was to help people practice, say, speaking a second language like Chinese in a safer environment.
Okay, so that relates to the reason I had met you to begin with was I saw you at a conference in China, and you were actually giving your talk in Chinese, and I was very impressed, because not only was this another language that you spoke, but you actually speak how many others?
I also speak Japanese, French, and I speak, like, some Spanish, some Italian, some German, some Korean.
Your English is very passable as well.
Not bad.
So it's interesting to me, like, that actually ties into the work then. Like, I didn't associate it at the time, but I guess language was what got you into this particular field, right?
I was just, like, the idea of, like, how are humans able to understand language? And if we could create a computer system that understood human language, then maybe we could understand how we were doing it. And it just...
And do you see ML contributing to that field right now?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it isn't, like, Duolingo, I thought they were using some sort of crowdsourcing for some of their data that they're using about how people learn and are trained.
And that's how you learn exactly two words in French.
Exactly.
Le chat and...
Le chien.
That's it, yeah. You know, you're all set. I mean, that's like for vision models, right? You distinguish dogs and cats, so that's all you need for language, too. But, yeah, I feel like actually in the last couple of years, there's been huge progress in natural language processing from deep learning. So transformer networks were like a big breakthrough that's happened in the last couple of years.
Okay, transformer networks.
So there, the previous state of the art was these recurrent neural networks or sequence-to-sequence models, where you have this neuron that you repeatedly feed back into, and you can pass it variable length inputs, which is good for language. So this new type of... So one of the big breakthroughs for those recurrent neural networks was that you could use attention. So say you were translating a sentence from French into English. You read in the French sentence one character, a token at a time, let's say, or word piece or whatever you're using, and you have some kind of representation of that input that as the neural network understood it, and then you start trying to decode it or translate it into English. You can actually look back at what the neural network saw when it was reading in that sentence. And it made translation tasks especially a lot easier for these models. So this attention concept was huge. And so then there was this paper, Attention is All You Need. It's kind of a provocative title, but the idea was, like, instead of having this recurrent aspect to the model, why not just only have attention? There's actually also a feed-forward component, which is, like, these interconnected layers. But it's primarily... attention. So you feed in each of the characters and each of the tokens. And as you look at each token, you're also looking at each other token.
Okay.
Having a diagram probably helps.
Right. So the based on several things you mentioned, it seems like understanding why and how neural networks even manage to achieve, like, what they accomplish is super crucial. So I imagine there's a lot of research going into that, right? Like,
yes.
And this also ties, I imagine, to debugging. Like, how do you debug those things? How do you know, like, when it's wrong, why is it wrong? Like, what do you do about it?
Yeah, it's hard to tell, and it kind of depends on the failure mode. So, like, and it depends on what flavor of machine learning you're doing. So I've been doing a lot of reinforcement learning, and you're kind of looking, you're like, okay, the reward isn't going up, or the entropy is got, like, the reward went up, but then it stopped, and then entropy became very low. So the model became very confident, but it's still not doing well. And so I should make it explore more. You can look at various things like the magnitude of the gradient.
Right.
So it's definitely, like, an art, not a science so far. But
yeah, it sounds like, again, you need experience to be able to do it well.
So with like supervised learning, you can try to look at, okay, what mistakes is it making specifically? You can also look at, okay, you train a model and you look at as the data that it uses to learn, you see what errors it makes. And then you take a subset of held out data and that's your evaluation set. And if on the evaluation set you do way worse than you do on the training set, the data you saw when you learned, then you can make certain conclusions about
overfitting. So you withhold information from the neural net
exactly,
to be able to test it.
To see whether it generalized. Did it really learn
it
anything or did
cool.
it just memorize the answers?
I was thinking specifically about the language example too. Like it's not, one of the things I find difficult with language, even when, you know, learning important words like cat and dog, is is there are these subtleties in how words are used differently between languages. So it's not like there's a natural, like, well, this would be like that in another language. Well, no, it turns out that they don't do that kind of construction in that language. Even languages that I think of as being very close to the one that I speak ends up having very subtle dialect, or not dialect, just usage differences, right?
Where there's no one-to-one mapping, right?
Yeah.
So I think like part of how we capture that in the modern like NLP is like word embeddings. So you can have like, say, an ID for every word in your vocabulary, but that's not that interesting of a feature. But if you say, you can train these word embeddings, which are these vectors that represent some kind of meaning of the word, and you can sort of train those vectors such that they are more and more helpful for you in doing the task. And actually that seemed to be one of the reasons that this new architecture, this transformer network, does so well. So people thought at first the reason is it's able to better model these long-term dependencies. Like it doesn't forget what happened at the beginning of the sentence by the end because of the attention mechanism.
Which is very important in German.
Which is really important. But the because at the end they have the finally get the verb. But I think the what they found was that they looked at the embeddings or the representations that the model had made at each layer for each word. They found that they were much more predictive than, say, the embeddings that had been generated by the previous, like, state-of-the-art recurrent or sequence-to-sequence models. So I think that this how you represent words is very important, and they have multiple senses. So you can understand this word in the context of the words around it, and that's why this kind of attention-based models do so well, because they can adapt, they can understand. In this context, we meant bank as in like somewhere that you store money or versus on the side
of
the
river. So I assume they're also better at adapting to more languages.
Yeah.
Because in the past, I assume we never really did like, you know, all the possible combination of translations, because you want something in between that's more semantic than...
Yeah, maybe like it's a better interlingua. I think usually you have word embeddings like on each side. So you have like some embedding on the French side and then on the English side, but you can,
So another thing that I find interesting is, I guess I could almost call it like second order research. Like I love it when I see papers or articles about someone trying to find ways to defeat the neural nets, right? Like image recognition. I think not long ago I saw something like, oh, you know, there's a lot of like face recognition happening. Can we find a pattern that, you know, if you put it on yourself, like...
Oh, the adversarial example.
Yeah, it's like the AI will never see that there's a person there. and it's funny, that it's weird that it works. Like, so yeah, they were wearing, it looked like a painting, like hooked to their neck, and like suddenly like the AI doesn't see you anymore.
Yeah, it's very interesting that it shows like some kind of differences between how humans are perceiving images and how neural networks are perceiving them.
It turns out we're pretty good at recognizing patterns.
Yeah, exactly. I think there was some interesting work at ICLR. It was like one of the oral presentations on like convolutional neural networks. And they were basically recognizing, I think it was ImageNet images. And they found that the convolutional neural network or the machine learning model was like actually mostly recognizing textures. Whereas humans are recognizing shapes. So if you took like an alligator and like gave it cat fur or something, it looks like a cat to the model. And it's a spectrum to what extent you like weight texture versus shape. But humans were much more shape oriented. And so they created this new data set where they changed the textures and they trained the model on that. And they forced it to become more like humans. And it actually had better performance in overall. So I don't know. It's just very interesting.
Yeah, no, it is very interesting.
Well, it strikes me, I wonder if part of this relates to, like, we see an image and to us, that is a representation of a 3D thing. like our mm-hmm. mind is already thinking about what the situation would be like in the world,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to you hand an image to a computer, the computer says this is a 2D.
It's even beyond that, right? Like, because to a certain point, even you can show a kid a bad drawing of something, and then they can link it to the actual real world object or presentation.
Yeah, like, they can map that.
We can make pretty big leaps of.
Right.
That's right. I mean, I think they're like, say, was like style transfer, like. You can say take like a very like photorealistic picture and turn it into a cartoon. So clearly, they're able to understand
style
that.
Style transfer is my pet peeve. Like, I think it's a horrible idea.
Why so?
Because I love to take photos, and I'm a graphics guy, and I don't understand the point of like it's like, oh, I like the photos of, you know, that person or that kind of painting. I'm gonna make mine look exactly like theirs. Like, what's the point? I understand the appeal for people who work in that field, right? It's interesting, but as a goal, I'm a little.
I'm not sure what the end point is.
Right.
I've seen people make these beautiful art in their homes, like. They have the same, like, apple, and they've transformed Van Gogh style, all these different styles. The question is, like, if, let's say they wanted to sell that piece of art, I don't think they can. I don't know what the IP ownership is. Like, what is the style versus the shape?
I don't know. Even for myself, it sounds weird. It's like, oh, it looks like, you know, that artist, but it's not from them. So it's like,
I don't know.
So that's my very personal pet peeve.
Are there people generating music as well and things like that? I guess it's kind of like with games, like people...
Yeah, at least
eventually aren't
heard
for anything.
I heard a podcast about that. It was quite surprising the kind of stuff it could do, like classical music that, mm-hmm. you know, if I wasn't told that it was from an AI, I'm like, yep, sure, it's probably like Mozart or whatever. Like, I don't know classical music, but...
Yeah, one of my colleagues, like, I went to her poster at one of these big conferences, and she had one of those A-B tests, like, or Coke Pepsi tests. Like, I couldn't tell which was the AI and which was the human, the actual, like, Mozart or... Chopin or whatever.
I mean, there's only 88 keys on the keyboard, so, you know, clearly there aren't that many, you know, variations anyway, right?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Okay. I think we're probably near the end of time. What have we forgotten to ask about?
I think we did a pretty good exploration, but I mean, there's so many things we can talk
it's
about.
It's a deep field. And are we approaching another one of those winters then? Are we near the end of the ML?
I hope not. I don't think so. I feel like there's so much more we can do. So
yeah, it certainly seems growing and very, very trendy for the last couple of years here. So, well, cool. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.